No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Maria Sanchez, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So feel free to call in and be part of the discussion at 888-627-6008. Maria, how are you? How are you doing in the new year?
I'm doing well, thank you. My eldest got COVID and had serious respiratory issues. And, you know, this is census, taste and smell. But as of about midweek this week, he was finally starting to be better. No hospitalization. He was able to fight it off at home. But his bubble includes his girlfriend and his roommate, who both tested negative, so no one knows how he got it.
Yeah, you know, I had a couple of elderly friends, they'd kill me for saying that. They're my age. But two of my best buddies, and they got it, and one of them has COPD and some other underlying issues, and they both fully recovered with very little other than flu-like symptoms. So, you know, and then I read in the paper today an 18-year-old died. You know, so, God, this is such a strange, strange sickness. But I'm glad that it seems that he's on the mend.
And he's my Nicholas. And I know you have your Nicholas.
Oh, he's your Nicholas. Yeah.
The thing I'm worried about as a psychologist is the mental health issues that are affecting 30 to 40% of them. I'm taking two classes next month about COVID and mental illness and, you know, PTSD or an anxiety or psychotic moments or whatever. That's more troubling to me almost than the physical ramifications.
Yeah. And we were going to have somebody on the show to talk about it. We weren't able to get them a few weeks ago, but maybe we'll get them back because, yeah, there was that one study that showed one out of five people that get it have psychological problems afterwards. So,
and even the asymptomatic folks are getting it. So we need
that's
to
amazing.
Arm ourselves with that.
Well, before we bring on our guests, I have a couple of things to say. First, I want to, you know, say that I was so sorry to hear that one of my heroes, Hank Aaron, died this week. You know, he was a fine gentleman, a great athlete, and he just never gave up being engaged. Just a few weeks ago, he publicly took a vaccination, you know, to encourage other people to do it as well. Right to the very end, he was an amazing man. So my condolences, our condolences, I'm sure I speak for you as well, Maria, go out to his family and his friends. And also journalist Larry King.
Yeah.
I worked for Larry King for 2 years, yes. When I had my consulting firm, I worked on his cardiac foundation. Now, not a lot of people know this about Larry, but, you know, Larry had a heart transplant like 40 years ago. He's been living with somebody else's heart for all that time. Two transplants, I think he had. And he had a cardiac foundation where he threw a big dinner every year and raised millions of dollars for people that couldn't afford the heart transplants. He would subsidize their care so they could get what they needed. So it was a great organization. I'm sure it's still going on. I got to work with the dinner for 2 years and it was a great cause and a lot of fun. So again, we wish his wife and kids and the rest of his family the best.
Well, he filed for divorce last year after 22 years of marriage.
That was his second or third wife.
It was his eighth wife.
I'm sorry, his eighth wife.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. You know, that's funny because I worked for Larry in the capacity of his I worked with his attorney. And his attorney at the dinner got up and said, some little boys dream of growing up to play in the major leagues. He said, I'm a divorce attorney. And I got Larry King as a client, what greater thing could happen? And I just thought of that. Yeah. Eight wives. Gosh.
Seven women, eight wives, because he married one of them twice.
Eight wives. Eight women telling you that you need to get better.
Take the trash out.
Take the trash out. Well, anyway, he was quite a figure. So we wish all of his eight ex-wives all the best. First, now that we've sent out our condolences, let us introduce our guest for tonight, who's just a wonderful guy. I've known him for a very long time. He's been on the show, and that's Hector Rodriguez, Captain Hector Rodriguez, retired veteran who went to the inauguration. Hector, are you with us?
I am with you. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. It's so nice. Victor founded a group called Veterans for DC Statehood. They've been very effective, of course, because veterans are our strongest allies. It's really hard to tell a man or woman that stood up for our freedom that they shouldn't be equal. So every time that we go up to Capitol Hill with veterans, they really, really help our cause. And so we thank you for that, Hector. And in recognition of his work, I don't know if people know this, but normally they give out 20 or 25,000 tickets to the inauguration. Well, this year they gave every member of Congress a ticket plus one so they could bring a guest. And Eleanor Holmes Norton, our delegate to Congress, chose Hector because of all his great work with veterans. And so that in itself was quite an honor. Tell us, Hector, how was the inauguration? What did you think?
The inauguration was amazing. We saw all the National Guard people all over the streets protecting everybody. We saw members of Congress, of course, at the site. The setting was interesting because the members of Congress were somewhat separated from the other dignitaries that were invited, like former President Clinton, President Obama, and some of the others. And by the way, I was so thrilled that I got a salute from President Clinton. I wore my Veterans for DC Statehood uniform, and I got a salute from Clinton and a shake of a knuckle shake from President Obama. Even J-Lo, I got a chance to talk to. What I did was I went down to where the barrier was, which is only waist high, and got a chance to interact a little bit with some of the other honored guests. I was very pleased and humble that Congresswoman Norton invited me as her special guest. One thing we always had in common, that we are both working for D.C. statehood, and I consider Congresswoman Norton our leader for the statehood veterans because she has been there for over 33 years fighting for our what I call our political freedom.
Well, let me ask you.
The inauguration provided an opportunity, of course, to completely endorse the American dream. And, you know, what it showed to me was that some people say America is fragile, that democracy is fragile. It is true. However, this election and this inaugural prove that America is indeed strong, and that the American people overall support our strive for freedom. And I always tell people, you know, I feel that God granted us, gave us freedom, and our country, government does not grant freedom. God gave us freedom. Government does not grant it. However, it is my belief that government is there to defend freedom. And a government that defends freedom is called a democracy. We are a democracy because we as a nation defend freedom, not only for ourselves, but for the world.
Well, that's an important point you make about, you know, as Thomas Jefferson said, we had these rights bestowed upon us by God, because a lot of times people act like we're asking for something. We're really not asking for anything more than everybody else has. We're asking for the restoration of what God gave us. But let me ask you a question. If you got to meet J-Lo, what were you wasting your time with Obama and Clinton for? I would have been standing there talking to J-Lo the whole time if I got to meet her. But that's great. It's great that you got to do all that. And had you been to other inaugurations?
No, I had not been to other inaugurations. This is the first inauguration that I was able to attend. Incredible to be able to be there to represent the people of the District of Columbia and our veterans, and it's just an amazing opportunity to do that at the presidential inauguration.
Yeah, that was quite an honor.
So we Maria, have a caller, Harold Thomas, on the line. Actor, do you know Harold?
Yes, he is a member and vice chair of Veterans for D.C. Statehood.
Oh, great. Harold, do you want to say hello?
Hello, Hector. Hello there again, Mike.
Hey,
good
hi.
Good seeing you. Good talking with you. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Okay. Do you have a question for Hector, or you want to say something nice about Hector?
Yeah, Hector's a nice guy. Hector is a hard worker, and he's true to the cause, and I support him, and I'm just proud to be associated with him in the vice chair of Veterans for D.C. Statehood, and we are also titled the American Eagles. Who we are.
Let me say something about
That's
this man. This man calling
and we, you know, we just celebrated our first year anniversary for the Veterans for D.C. Statehood movement. And I had the honor of introducing our Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton at our, first event down at Freedom Plaza. And until D.C. is free, you know, democracy is not free. You know, we are veterans and we fought, you know, for everyone. You know, freedom, but yet we've been denied the freedom of statehood, you know, for D.C.
It's and, so ironic.
You know, I'm going to say that it's time, you know, for D.C. to have statehood. Now, well, I was told by our delegate, Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton, that it would take a majority vote from the floor, both houses, you know, to grant D.C. statehood, and we would no longer need the ratification of any other state to ratify and approve statehood for D.C.
That's right.
I'm going to leave it up to Hector to be our spokesman, and I'm just delighted. I'll be listening, Hector. I'm not going anywhere. So thanks again for allowing me to have a few words, okay?
Thank you, Harold, and thank you for your service.
Yeah, Harold, thank you for your service.
I'm proud to have served.
Yeah, Mike, this gentleman represents one of our outstanding veterans who has been there all along, and he did receive the Veterans for D.C. Statehood Medal. We have an award called the Statehood Freedom Medal that we give to veterans who have distinguished themselves. Along with me and others, led a visit to meet with different congressional people. I have pictures of that, and we went door-to-door meeting with members of Congress to enlighten them about our need for statehood. And I have pictures of that And so I'm very proud of the work that he and other veterans in our city for the contributions they've made.
Well, you know, that's one thing about veterans, right, Hector? Hector, you can always count on them. They always have your back. They're, you know, I'm proud to say that veterans of foreign wars and disabled American veterans and the American Legion have all given me awards for work that I've done with veterans. And it's an honor to work with veterans. They're the most stand-up people on the planet, without a doubt.
Well, you know, speaking that, of that, we also have a Purple Heart winner in our organization, and we have all kinds of veterans who have distinguished themselves in their career, and my job is to highlight them and what they're doing. And but I want to tell I want to talk to the people in Washington D.C., veteran and non-veteran. I want everybody now to stand up, let the Congress hear you with a telephone call or a letter. Help us fight for your own freedom. We're fighting for your own political freedom. And so I want every person who's listening to this broadcast from Washington, D.C., and others to write a letter with your signature to the members of Congress or make a call and to remind them that without statehood, without a vote in Congress, the people of Washington, D.C. are not free. And I want to say to you that there's a kind of Republican Confederacy in the Congress of the United States that has kept us from having our political freedom. And that sometimes I wonder if it's because D.C. has been a predominantly black population. Is that why they won't vote for our freedom? Is it that they just want those two votes for something else? So we urge the Republicans in the Congress that now is the time that our bills are being presented to the House and the Senate. Now is your time to set us free with your vote.
Well, that's well said, and it's true that it has been a partisan thing for a very long time. Race has certainly played an issue, but we also have to remember that for the first 150 years of the existence of the District of Columbia was predominantly a white city. So it is about race, it is about partisan politics, and it is time to change it. And we have Kyle on the line, I think. Gee, we should have had Hector on more often. He's very popular.
Yeah. Welcome to BBS Radio, Kyle.
Hi, thank you. Thank you, Senator, for the work you do advocating on support of veterans and in support of statehood. And Hector, thank you for the work you do as well, again, for veterans and for statehood. And I want to underscore, you know, kind of what you were talking about just a minute ago and how important it is for D.C. residents to stand up and make their voices heard and for, you know, the people around the country to stand up and say, hey, this is an important issue. D.C. statehood needs to be a reality because it really is about the representation of our fellow citizens in Congress, and it's a real important issue.
Yeah, it really is. Thanks, Kyle. And it's like the ultimate voter suppression issue, right? I mean, 712,000 taxpaying veterans, as you can hear, and people that have been a part of America since America began. So, yeah, it is an important issue. And I think, Kyle, most people are starting to realize that it's not just about D.C. It's about our democracy and it's about the whole country.
Well,
thanks for sure.
When you talk about what you do for the lesser of individuals, you do for everyone.
Yeah.
And I see that about this D.C., you know, for statehood. But as I mentioned to you, Senator, and I don't know, Hector, if you heard this, but on Thursday, January 21st, at the White House briefing, a reporter asked Jen Psaki, the new, what do you call her, press secretary? What is President Biden's stance on D.C. for statehood, and will the bill be on his desk within the next 100 days? So what was cool about that is it was being discussed nationally. Well, what she said was, I haven't spoken to him in the last 36 hours about it, but I will get back to you because I don't have the answer to that, which they get to say now, you notice, in the Biden presidency. They're like, we'll get back to you because, you know, we're supposed, you know, Trump used to have them always have the answer whether it was right or wrong. And now they're able to say, we don't know. We'll get back to you, which I love.
Well, you know what, Maria, the very next day, it's very, very, you know, exactly what you said is happening. People are talking about it. The very next day, she was asked the same question, a similar question by another reporter. And she said that the president was for it, but she had no timetable for it. But, you know, they said, when do you think it's going to happen? She said she doesn't know, but the president's for it. And you know, we have a steep hill to climb in the United States Senate because we have to do one of two things. We have to get rid of the filibuster or suspend the rule, which means suspend the filibuster in order, it looks like, to get enough support in the Senate. Either that or we have to convince 9 Republicans to join with all the Democrats, and we have to get all the Democrats, which we haven't gotten yet. So there's still some heavy lifting to do, but yeah, we're closer than we've ever been before. And people are talking about it, and that's really, really what's important.
So I was curious if we could ask Hector about your organization, Hector, the Veterans United for DC Statehood. What was the genesis of this, and why did you feel the need, and what do you think you're solving by having this organization in place?
The one thing that I felt, it was about 2014 when we got together, and the first thing that went to my mind is this: how can we fight and die for America's freedom when we ourselves are not granted that freedom? For example, we have veterans throughout every war from D.C. that have fought. For example, First World War, first of all, we had veterans, people fight for our freedom even in the Revolutionary War. First World War, we had 25,000 of veterans fight for in the United States from D.C. 635 D.C. Soldiers died for our freedom. Second World War, 89,000 veterans from D.C., soldiers from D.C. fought in the war. 3,839 soldiers from our city died, more than four states. Korean War, we had 547 died, more than eight states. Vietnam, we had 243 citizens of D.C. died, more than 10 states. So that, you know, we looked at this and we said, we've got to bind ourselves together, get people in ranks, and let the Congress of the United States know that this has gone far enough, that we veterans are going to continue to be warriors for freedom. Everybody joined in, and as you can see, our organization has blossomed. More people are falling in ranks. And let me say to you that we are forming a strong coalition with our partners in the civilian community. We are fighting together now for one thing, the political freedom of the people of the District of Columbia.
And let me point out that the 25,000 veterans that Hector talks about in World War One, they weren't even allowed to vote for president. Yeah. And neither were the veterans who served from Washington, D.C. in World War II. They weren't even allowed. We weren't allowed to vote for president until the 1960s. And even without their rights, I'm proud to represent a jurisdiction where the veterans stood up for our democracy in spite of being denied democracy themselves. So I think D.C. veterans are among the bravest and most noble veterans. Let me also ask you, because you were involved, you got me a little involved, and your organization was involved in the runoff elections in Georgia. I mean, that must feel great to know that you helped turn the Senate by working in those elections for Ossoff and Warnock. How do you feel about that?
We had excellent participation, and we also coordinated with the veterans a coordinator from the Veterans Caucus. Every state has a Veterans Caucus, and we touched base with the Veterans Coordinator in Georgia, and we worked together. You know, the stations were open to us, and our veterans called for the support of those two senators, which are now going to be fighting for D.C. statehood.
Yes, they're both D.C. statehood supporters.
Thanks. Are they really?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Oh.
Do we have another call? I think we have other callers. Is that right, Doug? Do we have another caller, or am I just imagining things?
We try not to support anybody who's not going to support us. That has stopped. We supporting people who are supporting us.
Well, so those that support you should, if they can, go to Twitter and vets the number 4 DC, and then you can follow what it is that you do there. And the other DC for statehood, right, Michael?
Yeah, absolutely.
On Twitter, yeah.
Yeah, on Twitter and Facebook, there's also a new website called Two More Dems, which is, you know, what will happen if the District of Columbia becomes a state. For right now, anyway, you'll get two more Democrats in the Senate. So we want Democrats everywhere. You know, like Hector went down to Georgia. They spent hundreds of millions of dollars, or groups did, to get two senators from Georgia. Worked real hard to get two more Democrats from Georgia. But guess what? You make D.C. a state, you get two more Democrats from the District of Columbia.
Well, that should be kept on the down low, don't you think? No, that's the reason the Republicans aren't interested.
I know, but I don't think it should be kept on the down low. You know that things change over time. And we can't... We said the same thing about Alaska and Hawaii, you know, that Alaska would never elect a Republican and Hawaii would never elect a Democrat. And we saw those things change. And
right.
They can certainly change in the District of Columbia over time. But, you know, for right now, yeah, I think every Democrat in America should stand up and say, yeah, let's put two more Democrats in the Senate. You know, the Republicans... The Republicans didn't shy away from jamming three Supreme Court justices into the Supreme Court. And I don't think we should shy away from who we are as a jurisdiction. But that's just my opinion.
Well, you know what? When I talk to Republicans, they say, well, you know, if we have D.C. as a state, then, you know, it would be Democratic only. I said, listen, if you do something for us, you know, you're going to get support from people in the District of Columbia. You know, how can we vote for you if you have not freed us to vote?
Yep. It's absolutely true. And you know what? We have Republicans in the district. We've got Maria. You know that. There's 6 or 8 of them. We lose
Or
count.
As McConnell said to me when you introduced me to him.
Yeah.
You said, she's a Republican from California. And he says, 1 of 3.
Yeah, exactly. So please don't hold that against me that I introduced you to McConnell. But,
of course I
wouldn't. Anyway, yeah, it's true. You know, we don't take California. We don't say, look, California, you can't have your rights because you're mostly Democrat. So,
it's time that we move on from that. We were the one that had Reagan as governor, to your point about change.
And Jerry Brown. You know, if a state can produce Jerry Brown and Ronald Reagan, well, then anything can happen in any state. Isn't that
That's
right?
True.
Well, Hector Rodriguez, thanks for being on our show. We want to give you a chance. Do you have anything else you want to say, Hector?
Yes. I want to pay a special tribute to our women veterans. Women are playing a very important part in the freedom of our country. People, members in our organization like Georgia Eves, Charlotte Johnson, who was a nurse for 32 years, people like Edna Donatelli and Antoinette Scott, who's a Purple Heart winner. I mean, our women, let's not forget, have played a vital part in the defense of our country.
Yeah, and thanks for that, Hector. You know, one of my proud accomplishments when I was a consultant is I got to work on the PR for the public relations for the women's gate at Arlington Cemetery when that was put in. I don't know if people know, but now when you enter Arlington Cemetery, there's a gate that's a tribute to all the women veterans who have served over the years. So, and all the families, you know, all the families that serve, because when your loved one goes into service, you all serve.
My brother, everyone. Yeah.
Yeah. My brother was a F-111 pilot. His wife was, and children were moved all over the world. He served in Thailand. He served in England. He served in Colorado Springs at the Air Force Academy. And for 25 years, he and his wife and his kids were jerked all around the place. I think my sister-in-law had every odd job you can imagine to make ends meet. So thanks to all the families that serve. Hector, Captain Hector Rodriguez, thank you so much for everything you do for statehood. Thanks so much for being on our show again. And we're going to have you back again because you're a friend of statehood and we appreciate everything you do.
Thank you. A respectful salute for everyone in the District of Columbia and especially for those who are out there fighting for our political liberty in Washington, D.C.
Thank you,
Hector. Veterans United for D.C. statehood.
And I still have my beret. I have my beret. And
I love the beret that Hector wears. I'd love to see you in your beret.
Well, you know what? It may need modification because my damn head is so big that it barely fits in the beret.
We'll make a special one for you, Michael.
Okay, thank you. Get one with an elastic band in the back, Hector. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We'll talk to you again soon.
Absolutely.
Yeah, you know, when I was in India, they gave me an honorary degree, Mother Teresa University, and they couldn't get the cap to stay on my head, Maria.
Really?
Everybody was wearing caps and gowns, you know.
Yes.
And they had a guy behind me holding my cap on my head.
Oh my goodness.
They couldn't stretch it. Yeah, it was horrible.
That's hilarious. A lot of people use those safety bobby pins to hold it on.
You know, they were very sweet about it. They're like, oh, we must have gotten this small inadvertently. I'm like, no, my head's gigantic. Anyway.
Hopefully not because of your ego.
Well, it depends on who you talk to. My wife and kids would say that that's at least a contributing factor.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, we have so many things to talk about, Maria, and the first thing that I want to talk about with you, because you're a Republican and because you understand that I feel that it's important to have a healthy Republican Party, just like it is a healthy Democratic Party, what do you think's happening now in the Republican Party? Do you have a feeling about that? We see this schism that has developed between, let's say, regular Republicans, you know, and Trump Republicans.
Right.
But it seems to me that the Trumpers are going away quickly. Does it seem that way to you?
So my take on this is that the Messiah that was Trump promised Armageddon and apocalyptic circumstances. And when that didn't happen, even though we have the insurrection that did happen on January 6th, I think a lot of them felt disillusioned and foolish and like they were exposed to and about to drink the Kool-Aid and there, but for the grace of God, they didn't. So I see that as happening with the followers, which, you know, they say 74 million people voted for him, but they also say that really his base is about 20 or 25% of that. But I also see this as a time for Republicans to really look in the mirror and to say, do we want to go back to what we stand for, which is less government and more entitlement to people, give them the opportunity to teach them how to fish instead of just giving them the fish, fiscal conservative, et cetera. and do it without Trump so that we can move forward in 2024 and not have to worry about his grip on the party. And it's going to take 17 senators to do that, right, Michael?
Yeah.
And that's voting for his impeachment and keeping him from running for office ever.
I'm telling you, if that would happen, I would find that absolutely amazing. But yeah, I think you're going to see some of that at least happening.
Well, look at the bipartisan votes on the few cabinet positions.
Yep.
I mean, it's been extraordinary, and I've been heartened by that. That
me too.
Maybe they are willing to work towards compromise. Maybe with this $1.89 trillion bailout thing that they're doing, they might take away the minimum wage part of it and just make it be about COVID. If we can see some movement like that, I can see some great things happening for our country.
Well, yes, I think that I hope you're right. And I think that we've seen this many times before in American history, that when we've had these great moments of I don't know what to call them, maybe introspection, mm-hmm. that great changes have happened. We've seen great changes come out of turmoil, the First World War, the Second World War, the 1960s. You know, we were going to have another guest on the show who had to delay. Maybe we'll have him on in the near future, who said that 2020 was the worst year ever, worse than 1968. And I remember 1968, so I'm not sure I agree with that. 1968 was a pretty tough year. We lost.
We lost 400,000 Americans to COVID, we had Black Lives Matter, George Floyd, et cetera. And I would say that's pretty bad.
It's pretty bad. It is pretty bad. But we saw the changes that came out of the 1960s. Maybe we'll see the same kind of change coming now. I think people want change. I think they want, that we want to make a better world. This, they say, is the first generation where they won't, my children, your children won't be as well off as we were. And that's sad. You know, I look at my kids, I feel sorry all the time. When I got out of college, I looked in the newspaper. Do you remember what a newspaper is?
Yeah.
Maria, I looked in the
newspaper.
I still
actually get one delivered every day.
Yeah, me too. Me too. And my wife scratches her head like, why?
No, but, I like
but,
it.
But me too. But I looked in the newspaper and I found a job in the Watt ads. And mm-hmm. that blows my kids away. They're like, Dad, that doesn't happen anymore. Mm-hmm. And if you open up the Watt ads in the Washington Post, it's about, instead of being like 20 pages like it used to be, it's like two small columns of very strange things. But anyway.
But to that end, Michael, I had a real troubling phone call with a girlfriend who's got a daughter who's our children's age, who was married in October of 2019 and feels like she is out of water. She doesn't recognize the world that is around her. She doesn't understand anything anymore. Nothing makes sense with the unemployment, with the poverty, with the people being hungry, with the evictions, with all of that. She's shaken to her core to the point where she had a nervous breakdown because this isn't the United States that she thought we were. And this is a young woman, like maybe 30, that is so shooken by what has happened to our world. And then I have another girlfriend whose daughter got brainwashed by QAnon. And she lives in Northern California. She's in her late 20s. She's leaving her husband. She's quitting her job. She's moving to Southern California. She's an alien, and she's been matched up with another alien, and it's all QAnon. And this is our kids' reality.
Yeah, and it's scary because, the first incident you're talking about, Maria, this isn't what we taught our kids America was. This is not what we taught them. It's not what we were taught America was, and it certainly isn't what we taught our children that America was. So,
and yet it is. And that's and what's yet, the yes, problem. Right. I mean, I started to cry when I heard her repeat her daughter's words, because for her daughter at that age, at least we have wisdom. We have some decades of experience to know how great America has been and can be. But imagine that, well, your children are that age, that they're looking around and going, what? Like the social injustice and the social inequity, and even with the vaccinations being rolled out and the black and brown communities and their hesitancy and their inordinate ability to suffer from COVID. And I mean, it's happening. We're not making this up.
Well, and you know what? My kids are the same way. I mean, in terms of their rhetoric, a lot of the things that they say reflect exactly what you're talking about. Right now, and you know, when, and I grew up in a protest generation in the 1960s and early 1970s, but we had a same, you know, we didn't have the issues these kids had.
Right.
We had jobs.
Yes.
We had a future. We were against the war. We thought it was the wrong thing, and you know, we didn't have anything against the Vietnamese, and we didn't know why we were over there, but that's what brought us together, a common cause. Now there are so many things out there, so many
well,
things.
Well, especially because it's about. Domestic. It's not
yes.
foreign.
Yes, it is. And that is a big difference, you know, that we're because that makes them doubt what the future can bring. And, you know, I always
and who
remember,
to trust.
Yes.
Who do you trust?
And that's what was so terrible about this election fraud thing. But, you know, I often think of the fact that in his great work, Dante wrote in the Inferno, over the gates of hell, let all who enter give up all hope, because he couldn't think of anything more horrible that you could say about the human condition, then there is no hope. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if we don't inspire young people to have hope, you know, it really is debilitating.
And, well, North Korea, case in point.
Yeah.
Those people, there is a somber intergenerational or transgenerational depression since they have become what they've become. What hope do they have?
Well, I'll tell you what hope I have, and I know it's the same hope you have, and that hope is Amanda. Was that young woman amazing at the inauguration? I mean, she's got twice as, she gave the best speech of anybody up there. She had more poise than anybody.
Her eloquence was staggering.
At 22 years old.
Yes.
So, I mean, there's hope. Because yes. There's people like Amanda,
but and how adorable that she talked about this skinny black girl was raised by a single mom in Los Angeles, I might add, and at 16 she's a poet laureate.
Yeah,
you know, and yes, her imaging and her words and her delivery and her poise and her confidence, and I mean everything about her was just, I mean jaw dropping.
Yeah,
I'm like,
and you know, I laugh because Karen said to me immediately that day, and Karen Zolgit is the woman that books people for this show, and she helps us. She's my chief of staff, and let me give a shout
right
out.
Right arm.
But she suggested that we invite her on the show, which we will do. But it was, I said, I don't think right now. And then the next day she was on the Today Show, Good Morning America, CNN, the New York Times, you know. She was the it person. You know that now she's a best-selling author because the day after her speech, Amazon, her book of poetry went right to the top of the bestsellers list. So,
and her jacket, her yellow jacket sold out.
Oh, you know what? Yeah, she was just perfect in every respect. Even I re-looked at the video, and even the way she used her hands as she spoke.
Yes.
She has lovely hands. She's a very lovely woman.
Yeah.
She has lovely hands. She used them effectively. She's, you know, that's one of the problems I have. Sometimes they tell me I'm pounding my, somebody told me one time I was pounding on a podium, and they said, who are you, Nikita Khrushchev? Come on. You know,
and we have James on the line.
Okay,
James, welcome to Shadow Politics.
James.
Hi, everybody.
What's up?
How you doing, Senator Brown and your team?
Good. Yeah, we're all doing great. How are you?
I'm well. It's been a while since we've talked. Hector Rodriguez asked me to give a call in and try to continue to show the importance of statehood. So I'm following up on my good friend and comrade Hector Rodriguez's request.
Nice.
James, are you a veteran?
I absolutely am. Retired from Marine Corps.
Well, thank you for your service, sir. I've known many good Marines in my day. I used to live across the street from the Marine Barracks on Capitol Hill. Well, thanks for calling in, James. Anything else you'd like to say? I mean, you guys are so important to what we do because you stood up for America, and, you know, our opinion is now America needs to stand up for you.
Right. And that's the reason I'm calling, is to echo the importance of statehood and what it means from a legislative perspective for Washington, D.C. to be the 51st state. So I'm not going to take up a whole lot of time. I know it's getting towards the end of your show, but that's all I wanted to say. And thank you for
putting
on this
platform.
Well,
thank you for that, James.
Yeah, thank you, James, and thanks for your service.
Something, Michael. Thank you, James. That I wanted to add, that is a little footnote to President Trump, and it was due to the timing that it didn't get any publicity at all. But one of the few things that I think that he did that was admirable, especially in his last weeks in office, was on Tuesday, January 5th, he signed the legislation known as H.R. 6100, which is Stop the Female Genital Mutilation in the United States, and made it a federal law. And if he hadn't signed it, it would have died with his presidency. And there are 10 states plus the District of Columbia that do not have legislation in force to stop female genital mutilation. So that's another conversation that we need to have. But at least now we have a federal mandate, because in 1996, there was legislation that was passed, but a federal judge threw it out in 2018 saying it was unconstitutional. So I am intimately involved with the women that were involved in the wording of the legislation. And it was a great day. And unfortunately, January 6th followed it, and therefore, of course, it didn't get any publicity.
Well, you know, it's a horrible thing. You know, Maria, first of all, let me say that you deserve a lot of credit for being involved in this issue. When you first talked to me about it, I was just astonished by the figures that you gave me about how prevalent this is.
Yes.
If you had asked me before you enlightened me about it, I would have probably said something like, oh, it's a strange kind of religious practice that a handful of people are engaged in, not millions and millions of women around the globe. And
200 million.
And I was shocked to find out that anybody in America did it. I was,
and, yeah, 500,000 women in the United States.
Yeah, I found that amazing. And, you know, I think even when we talk about it now, it makes me uncomfortable. It's an uncomfortable thing to talk about, but it's something that we have to talk about, because it's so debilitating to the women that have to suffer this.
Yeah, lifelong complications.
And it's all born out of superstition and misinformation. Mm-hmm. You know,
tradition, custom. Some people wrongly think it's part of Muslim in the Quran, and it's not. It's nowhere in there. It's Judeo-Christian practices too. There's a sect from India that does it. And it's centuries old is the problem. And because it involves female genitalia, it makes everybody uncomfortable, which is why it doesn't get the notoriety that it should, because people, they're aghast at it. But interestingly enough, it was a black woman that introduced the legislation. She's from Texas, Sheila Jackson Lee. And
we love Sheila Jackson Lee. She's one of the big statehood supporters. Oh my God. I sat next to her at a dinner, and she was the most delightful dinner guest. I mean, I can't tell you. I went to, she supports HBCUs, historically black colleges and universities, and we ended up together at a table at the Thurgood Marshall dinner a few years ago, and I got to tell her how wonderful we think she is, because she's not only signs on to our bill for statehood, she's an outspoken supporter of statehood.
Well, it's ironic because she introduced it on March 5th, 2020, and it got signed on January 5th, 2021. And I don't know, do you think that's quick that it went through the House and the Senate?
Yeah, I think it is quick. And I think it's a lot, strangely enough, like D.C. statehood that, you know, people, when you explain D.C. statehood to them, they're generally supportive of it, but they don't know about it.
Correct.
So that's where the lack of support comes from.
Correct.
And I think it's the same type of ignorance here. I mean, I can't imagine anybody in our culture standing up and saying, oh, yeah, this is a good idea, you know,
right.
to have this practice. Good idea.
Yes.
You know, that
it's even
so
called...
when they know about it, you know, that, yeah, I think that, but yeah, I think that's pretty quick.
Because the global activists. They'll say things to me like, because when I get pushback here in America that I'm trying to get rid of this because I'm a white woman, and who am I to talk about something that occurs mostly in Africa? The women around the world say, because it's child abuse and it's violence against women.
Yeah.
It has nothing to do with color. This is wrong. I don't care if you're
yeah.
purple. This is
and
wrong.
It's child abuse, because that's when this happens. This happens when these young women are children.
Yeah. Yeah, mostly
and,
under the age of 15. So,
yeah.
by and large.
So when you ask a guy who's been working on an issue that's been going on for 220 years, and legislation took us 27 years to get a bill passed in the House in support of DC statehood, do I think a year is quick turnaround? Yeah, I think a year is quick turnaround.
Yeah. So that's thank you for that, because you know this is my passion. So,
well,
I wanted to share that.
You should get kudos for involving yourself in this battle, because it is an important battle. It's certainly important to the 200 million women that have suffered it.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we're running out of time here.
But I wanted to suggest something else. There's something being called, and it's kind of tongue-in-cheek, but it's called Trump Recovery Syndrome, TRS. Mm-hmm. And they say it's a phenomenon whereby we were triggered by President Trump, and we go through a series of stages before we calm down and feel peace and release our anxiety and recalibrate our nervous system and our emotion and our hypervigilance and all the things that went through, like, what is he doing now that we get away from it? So they say that Trump Recovery Syndrome, or TRS, you can approach it as you would any recovery, and just let it take its course and take some deep breaths and get some closure.
I just want to tell you that Mrs. Brown has found a shortcut, and it's called wine.
I was going to say.
So, a
martini.
she's found the shortcut to Trump recovery syndrome. But I wanted to leave a minute or two early tonight, because we're going to play a song. You know, usually we play it in honor of our guests. I'm sure this Hector won't mind this, though. We're going to play a song that's a little longer than normal. It's for Hank Aaron. It goes out to one of my heroes, Hank Aaron. I know you're a baseball fan.
Yes.
I'm
a fan of him especially.
Yeah, especially. And so here's Whitney Houston with One Moment in Time, for a man who certainly had one moment in time. Thanks for listening, folks. Maria.
And we thank our listeners, as always. We so appreciate the honor to be in your ears at your convenience.
day I live, I want to be a day to give.
Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.